Welcome to Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. So you know what happens. One minute it's 15th of October. The next minute you blink and it's November. Then you sigh and it's December. And next thing you know, it's the end of the year. And you're lining up to maybe have a bit of a holiday, spend some time with family. If you're lucky, you've got a little bit of downtime. You can go and lie on a beach or lie on a balcony or lie in your bed or lie on your couch and just take a little bit of a breather before we're hit by 2025. And that means we're starting to think about the books that we want to read from now till the end of the year. So we're going to help you with that because Book Choice is this country's only 1 hour long book review show. We've got a bunch of fantastic reviewers and they're joining us today to talk about their favorite books that they've been reading this month. We're going to start off the show with Shirley Gula, who's going to be talking about a local thriller. It's called The Finish Line. It's by Gail Schimmel. We have mentioned this book on the show before. After that, we're going to go to a big best-selling mystery writer, Tana French, and her novel is called The Hunter. Beverly Rose Miller is going to be chatting about that. After that, we're going to turn to Rachel van der Pfeffer, who's our young adult novel reviewer, and she's going to be chatting about a book called Gentlest of Wild Things by Sarah Underwood. I must say, every month, I'm more and more impressed by the covers that they're giving these young adult titles. They've got really impressive covers, and this one is also a beautiful cover. After that, we're going to turn to some non-fiction. Twangie Kalula will be chatting about Jonathan Jansen's latest memoir, which has been quite anticipated. It's called Breaking Bread. We're going to stay with nonfiction then, and we're going to turn to nature with John Hanks, who's going to be chatting about the ways and wonders of South African trees. We always look forward to our nature segment on this show. After that, because summer's coming, summer is upon us, we've got a book called Become Your Best Body by Justin Harvey. You know what they say? Summer bodies are made in winter. They also say, if you've got a body, you've got a summer body. And then the cherry on top of the show is we've got a huge interview at the end of the show. Vanessa Levenstein chats to Sipiwe Gloria Ndlovu, who has to be one of our very favorite authors. And her latest novel is called The Creation of Half-Broken People. We just about came to blows over who would get to read and interview the author on this one, but Vanessa is such a huge fan that she had to do it. And I can't wait to hear what these two have to talk about because this is a highly anticipated novel. In fact, I'm going to put my money on it now and I'm going to say this novel is going to be up for the Sunday Times Literary Prize next year. You heard it here first. And that'll be our show for today. So before we get to our first review, which is of The Finish Line, a thriller by local best-selling author Gail Schimmel, how about some music? We're going to play Told You So by Vota Kellerman. And you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. And this incredible show is sponsored by our incredible partners, Exclusive Books. Here comes some music.
Thank you.
That was Told You So by Vota Kellerman, and you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. Right, we've got a huge lineup this month, as we always do, so let's not dilly-dally, let's get straight into the books. We're starting off with a review from Shirley Guler, who read The Finish Line by Gail Schimmel. Gail Schimmel is a local South African author. She writes domestic thrillers. They're pacey, they're page-turnery. If you like a domestic thriller, we can all highly recommend a little bit of Gail Schimmel. In fact, I've said this on the show before, but my mother always says that Gail Schimmel is her favorite South African author. So she reads an awful lot, so it's a good recommendation. Welcome to the show, Shirley Guler. Did you enjoy The Finish Line as much as my mother, Hilary Nick, did?
If you told me I would read a book about a young girl, I would have laughed. If you told me I would sometimes be very moved by that young girl, I would have hooted. That said, The Finish Line by Gail Schimmel is about joy, about every man, and about South Africa. It's also about not fitting in, and that affects us all. Schimmel guides us through the life of Brenda from her childhood to becoming mother of the bridegroom, and she makes us fall in love with her, with her foibles, her insecurities, her naivete, and her clear thinking. A doctor later, Brenda is a misfit for much of her young life. Brenda is an athlete like very few of us. She has odd parents like we all thought we had. It's about friends and enemies, love and loyalty, devotion, betrayal, and manipulation. Brenda is the lowly born sweet girl, and she needs to deal with the so-called friendship of Denver, another good but less good runner. The friendship lasts over many decades of ugly betrayals, breakups, and makeups, and they are quite dramatic. But the sudden breakups and the sudden makeups are not always totally believable. There needed to be more complex reasons. Her sideline friends are better friends, but manipulators always seem to have the upper hand. The Finish Line is about questioning who you are and who the others are. Is it money in the upmarket suburbs or the life of the school teacher that is the more honest? A lot is explained when Brenda speculates that the house in the best part of Pretoria was bought because it was large enough to accommodate the ego of the British son. We have snobbish, vacuous mothers and private school education versus the really odd mother of the looked-down-upon scholarship girl. Much of it is a facade, a perfect facade to hide the imperfections of the snooty, leafy suburbs. It's about comparisons. Rich parents with everything but love and real style versus ordinary parents with no parenting skills. A family holiday meant taking the child to wait at the finish line of the comrades. If I have any reservations, it is that I would have liked the real friends, the alphabet girls, Imam and Gabriella, to be more developed. Schimmel mentioned in an interview that her own mother was a misfit, a Jewish girl in a high Anglican school. But most of us at some stage perceived ourselves to be misfits too. We had to have been adopted because our parents were simply not who we were. We are, for the most part, wanting to be in the right place at the right time, rather like Brenda. The book is set against changing times as domestic issues and fledgling relationships across what used to be a color separation. Good people are not always good, and bad people are superficially good, and Schimmel has imbued the two main characters with believable traits for the most part. It's a good story, nothing like I expected. And as it draws to a close, I feel sort of sorry they're out of my life.
Thank you, Shirley Guler. We're going to come back to Shirley a little bit later in the show because Shirley also read some nonfiction this month and she's going to tell us about Becoming Your Best Body. But before that, we want to talk about more fiction. And we're going to go to an internationally best-selling Irish author. I love Irish authors. Anne Enright is one of my very favorite, but I'll pretty much read anything. Niall Williams. Oh, Niall Williams is another favorite international Irish author. And Beverly Rose Miller read Tana French, and her latest is called The Hunter. Welcome to the show, Beverly Rose Miller and Tana French with your book, The Hunter.
The latest masterpiece by Irish writer Tana French, The Hunter, is not only a mystery novel. A slow burner, it digs a deep trench into the very private world of Ardna Kelty, a tight-knit village way off the beaten track in Ireland's heartland. Cal Hooper, an ex-cop from America who first appeared in The Searcher, the earlier novel in the series, has set up a carpentry business in this backwater, not in order to hunt for his Irish roots, a frequent pastime for Americans, but looking for quiet after a life of dealing with criminals and lawlessness. Here he has found great value, a sturdy, independent woman with whom he has a relationship, and a fierce 15-year-old girl, Trey, with a feckless, absent father, a struggling mother, and a young sibling she tries to support and protect. Cal is teaching her carpentry, for which she has shown a talent. Then Trey's charming, lying, con man of a father arrives back, reclaims his family, and spins a story about an Englishman who's heard of gold in them thar hills. Gold lust begins to addle the minds of his former village neighbors who, despite knowing he's not to be trusted, can't resist the intrigue, what the Irish call the crack, disrupting the boredom of a place where little ever happens besides generations-long feuds about land boundaries and old grudges. Fed into the prickly mix is the burning weather, for this is no normal Irish green summer. Endless weeks of broiling heat, smelting normally sensible brains, hot winds bullying the mountainside and drying the dying crops. Smooth Englishman Rushborough arrives with tales his granny told him, of gold in rivers or perhaps under the local magic mountain, and sure, why not? Old ornaments of gold have indeed been found in the vicinity, and at least one benefit of her scheme is that it's something to argue about in the local pub, a proud Irish tradition. Yet, Trey knows that her father has never told a straight story in his life, and she is also driven by vengeance for her brother Brendan, who's been missing these past 2 years. Trey is determined to exact a form of ancient justice, literally that of outlaw, where the community declares someone outside the reach of procedural law and may deal with them in any manner they choose, trusting the silence of the community, as would a Sicilian. They may disagree vehemently and sometimes even fatally with each other, but the greatest sin is to let any outsider know about their doings. Local, impenetrable justice. Who can stop the worst from happening? Well, there's Cal for one thing, a former cop. His fatherly love of Trey and his determination to make this wild place his home sees him drawn into a conspiracy in which the best outcome is the least terrible consequence, for there are no good ones. Tana French, who is a former actress, writes intensely with superbly crafted dialogue, true to the Irish form and yet accessible. I admit to enjoying some Irishism from my childhood. The writing is so strong, so well-crafted, that despite its slow pace, I was captivated right to the unpredictable ending. French is a fine literary novelist, and The Hunter elevates mystery and thriller writing into the major league. I was mightily impressed.
How about some music? Before we head into our young adult title for the show, I thought this was an appropriate track. We're going to be listening to The Child in You by Tina Skoe.
I remember when I was a child, after spending the day running wild, I'd retire to my aunt's room. I'd wear her jewelry and I'd smell her perfume. And I'd say, I want to be grown up and big like you. I want to do the things that grown-ups do. I want to wear lipstick and tease my hair. I paint my toenails red and make people stare. She'd say, slow down, hear what I say. Your time will come to be a woman someday. Just treat yourself with more love and more care. Love the child you are inside. That's a dare. That's a dare. Now I'm big, I do the things that grown-ups do. I don't get chicken pox, I just get the flu. I spend my time running around all day. There's time for work, but there's no time for play. I am exhausted, Tina Stress is my name. But being an artist, it comes with a game. Dear Dr. Groom would say I'll take some time out. He obviously doesn't know what my life's about. He says, slow down, hear what I say. You got to find time, there must be a way. Treat yourself with more love and more care. Love the child you are inside. That's a dare. That's a dare. Old William Shakespeare once put it this way: to thine own self be true as night follows day. Thou canst not then be false to any man. Take heed of the picture, take heed of the plan. Look to yourself, in that there lies the key. Everything you are is what life can be. Love lives inside you, it's your shining sun. Open its doors and this love will reach everyone. Will reach everyone. This thing called life moves by so fast. Before you know it, it's gone in a blast. And just the other day, I nearly died when a drunken driver crashed into my side. Well, that got my attention. I was quite wired at the thought that I had nearly been retired. I made a promise to myself, I'll be nice, and I will heed the good doctor's advice. Slow it down, hear what I say. You got to find time, there must be a way to treat yourself with more love and more care. Love the child you are inside. That's a dare. That's a dare. Look into yourself and that there lies the key. Look into yourself and that there lies the key. Look into yourself and that there lies the key.
Welcome back. You're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your bookie host, Paige Nick. And our show, as always, is sponsored by the wonderful people at Exclusive Books. What would we do without them? We are so grateful. That was The Child in You by Tina Skahl, which is appropriate because the next book we're going to hear about is a young adult novel. This is the portion of the show where we say, if you have a young adult in your life, if you have a child or a grandchild or a niece or a nephew or somebody who works for you who has a child who reads, a book is a fantastic gift for a young adult. And you know, books have become super cool for young adults. BookTok is exploding with millions of posts every month. And these authors who are writing these best-selling young adult novels have huge cult followings. And it's a very exciting time in the world for young adult literature. So what I'm going to tell you is, if you buy the young adult in your life a book, you might just be getting them something really cool. And you might avoid the old eye roll. So have a listen. Rachel van der Pfeffer is our young adult reviewer, and she's going to be chatting about Gentlest of Wild Things by Sarah Underwood. As I mentioned, this has a really cool cover. These young adult publishers have upped their game big time. Whether BookTok made them up their game or whether they upped their game and BookTok took over, I don't know, but it's working. Every single one of these, they're starting to have these really intricate and beautiful titles. So let's hear from Rachel van der Pfeffer if what's in the book is as fantastic as what's outside the book.
Gentlest of Wild Things by Sarah Underwood is a queer retelling of the Psyche and Eros myth. On the island of Zakynthos, desire is bottled and sold by Leandros, a powerful descendant of Eros, the god of love himself. When Leandros' wife mysteriously dies, he sets his sights on Irene's sister Phoebe. To protect Phoebe from marriage and discover the secret behind Leandros' desires, Irene makes a deal with him. If Irene can complete 4 tasks, she'll be allowed to marry Leandros in Phoebe's place. As she completes the tasks, Irene begins to unravel a mystery involving her tasks, the desires, and a mysterious daughter Leandros keeps hidden in a tower. I'm a big fan of Greek mythology, and I always enjoy reading mythological adaptions and retellings. Gentlest of Wild Things is one of my favorites so far. Unfortunately, I did pick up on what is supposed to be a major twist early on in the book because of my knowledge of the original myth, and I think other people might find the same thing. Luckily, I don't think it really impacted the entertainment of the story. Last year, I read and reviewed Sarah Underwood's debut novel, Lies We Sing to the Sea. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I think The Gentlest of Wild Things is even better. A common criticism of the first novel was the lack of research that people felt the author put into it. While this didn't really affect my enjoyment of it, I could tell that she's clearly put more research into Gentlest of Wild Things. I would thoroughly recommend this book to anyone who enjoys mythology, and in fact, I've already recommended it to a friend who's a big fan of the original Psyche and Eros myth. Gentlest of Wild Things is written by Sarah Underwood and published by HarperCollins.
Thank you so much to Rachel van der Pfeffer for joining us. Rachel, you're heading to the end of year at school. We wish you good luck with your exams. And thank you for sticking around with us and for reading while you've got a lot of studying to do as well. So I'm sure you're under a lot of pressure. Next up, we're going to turn to our nonfiction. And First up in our nonfiction reads, we've got a review of Jonathan Janssen's latest book. It's actually a memoir and it's called Breaking Bread. There's been a lot of press about this book. Jonathan Janssen is sometimes much loved. He also gets some criticism, of course, as all South African people of note do. And so this has been a bit of a highly anticipated memoir. And Twanji Kalula took his turn to read it, and he'll be telling us what he thought.
Prof. Jonathan Janssen is one of the continent's most popular thought leaders when it comes to education and politics, which is why it was quite unusual for him to peel back the curtain and give us more insight into who he is and how he came to be. I love his publisher's description of him on the sleeve of the book. It says, "Publisher, pundit, public nuisance." But in his first long-format memoir, Breaking Bad, he decides to drop the titles and focus on answering a question he gets asked often. Prof. Janssen, how did you become who you are? Like many South Africans, I only know him as a professor who isn't afraid to share his opinions, even when it upsets half of the people on social media. From the first page, we're taken to retreat in the Cape Flats. As the eldest son of very religious brethren parents named Sarah and Abraham, and yes, those are their real names, Jonathan enjoys a strict, insular upbringing. Although he's protected from the worst aspects of the gangsterism, violence, and the social ills that surround him, he's able to focus on his education and imagine life beyond the hardships plaguing his community. This discipline enables him to become a high school teacher and the first university graduate of his generation in his family. In the book, he describes a passion for teaching that really fires one up. In fact, I almost decided to register for a teaching diploma after I read a section of the book until I remembered that I cannot think of anything worse than spending my days with people who are going through puberty. But the classroom is a vehicle for change and in many ways the coalface of our society. And through this lens, one gets a true understanding of why Prof. Janssen is the way he is, why he's fearless about expressing his opinions, and why he's passionate about education reform. He also manages to highlight the challenges that apartheid posed and the legacy it has created without writing another apartheid book, which I think is quite difficult to do as a South African author. Throughout his life, Prof. Janssen has found himself facing difficult challenges and tumbling into hot water. And the figurative and sometimes literal act of breaking bread with his opponents has been pivotal to his success and finding mutual understanding with others. And I think what I really enjoyed about the way he has weaved these pearls of wisdom and life lessons into the text is that it's completely devoid of cheese. If you've ever seen Prof. Janssen speak, you will know that he is a brilliant storyteller. He grew up around charismatic evangelists, and this really manages to come through in the text. And though we are a generation apart and enjoyed very different upbringings, I was moved by the number of anecdotes that deeply resonated with me. The one thing I learned from this book is that everybody who has had a strict mother knows exactly what type of upbringing you'll have. So I roared with laughter at times and I felt complete despair at others. But ultimately, a good memoir should make the author relatable. It should be insightful and entertaining. And this lively read does exactly that. Breaking Bread by Jonathan Janssen was published by Jonathan Ball and retails for 340 Rand.
So those of you who don't know much about Jonathan Janssen, he is a professor of education at Stellenbosch University, and he's also the immediate past president of the Academy of Science of South Africa. He started his career as a high school biology teacher in the Cape, and he holds a PhD from Stanford as well as honorary doctorates from four universities, including the University of Edinburgh. Not scared of a textbook, this guy. Jonathan Janssen is the author of the award-winning book Knowledge in the Blood, and his recent books also include Corrupted, a Study of Chronic Dysfunction in South African Universities, that came out in 2023, and The Decolonization of Knowledge, which came out in 2022. He was inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and so he's very highly regarded and highly respected academic, and he has some very interesting and thought-provoking views on our education system. So I'm always interested when I see something new has come out from Jonathan Janssen. Thank you for that lovely review, Twanji. Again, we've got an appropriate track coming up. Before we turn to John Hanks, who's going to be talking about a book called The Ways and Wonders of South African Trees, we've got a track coming up, and it's called Norwegian Wood, and it's by Tessa. All the music on today's show has been very cleverly and carefully curated by Mzu Makete. He also pulls our whole show together. So thank you, Mzu. You've curated some fantastic and relevant tracks for today's show. Here's Norwegian Wood by Tessa. Welcome back. You're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. And as always, our show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. If you've missed any of the titles on this show, maybe you're driving and you didn't, I can sometimes talk too fast, sorry, I'll try harder. You might be driving and maybe you've missed one of the titles we mentioned on the show, or maybe you caught the title and not the author, or maybe you tuned in late and you've missed the first half of the show. Well, don't worry, we got you covered. We load the show as a podcast on fmr.co.za straight after the show, so you can go and listen to it at your leisure. We also cut some of our reviews up into a new segment we've got called Book Choice Shorts. So we take some of our favorite segments from the show, we cut them into 10-minute podcasts, and we load those onto the FMR website, so you can go and listen back to those. And now, as promised, after Norwegian Wood by Tessa, we turn to John Hanks, who's our nature reviewer, and he's going to be talking about a new book called The Ways and Wonders of South African Trees.
What a pleasure it has been to review a superb book with the title The Ways and Wonders of South African Trees, written by Willem Frost and illustrated with over 400 top-quality colour photographs, which must put this celebration of the beauty of South African indigenous trees in a class of its own. How trees fit in with other key components of our rich biodiversity is a topic the author explores with some fascinating new insights in the first part of the book, including the symbiotic relationship with other plants and animals. I was reminded here of the words of Sir David Attenborough, who gave these relationships a special status when he wrote, "Ancient trees are precious. There is little else on earth that plays host to such a rich community of life within a single living organism. End quote. Willem Frost has not only recognized and promoted this vitally important role that trees play in nature, but has also recognized the way in which trees contribute to slowing down or even reversing the rate of climate change. In addition to presenting authoritative accounts on the various parts of a tree and how they function, he encourages the reader to engage with the wonders of trees and to appreciate and understand how much they have to offer. In part two of the book, he selected 160 of our more conspicuous trees, with each one being beautifully illustrated with its common name in English, Afrikaans, and where available in the local African language. All have information on their unique traits, which accounts for how they are used by animals and humans. As an example, the baobab, which everyone will know, is recognized as the oldest living organism in Africa, with the really big specimens perhaps 4,000 years old. When the branches are bare, they look like roots reaching into the sky, giving rise to folklore which suggests that the first baobab was planted upside down. For centuries, people have used the hollow stems of baobabs for shelter and storage, and there are even accounts of these spaces being used as a prison and even a pub. The leaves and young sprouts are edible. The seeds can be roasted as a coffee bean, and the fruit pulp can be used to make a refreshing drink that is richer in vitamin C than orange juice. I hope that this one example alone will tempt you to look at similar accounts for all the other species. And if you still want convincing, considering the words of the British author Matt Haig, who wrote, "Finland is officially the world's happiest country. It is also 75% forest." I believe these facts are related. Really true words they are. The title again, The Ways and Wonders of South African Trees by Willem Frost. It's just been published by Straight Nature, an imprint of Penguin Random House, South Africa, and at 480 Rand, it is really good value.
Thank you so much, John Hanks. We're going to stick with nonfiction now. And Shirley Gula returns. She read two books for us this month. One was fiction. She read The Finish Line by Gail Schimmel at the beginning of the show. And then she turned to some nonfiction. And she's read for us a book called Become Your Best Body. It's by Justin Harvey, and it says here that it's a guide to permanent weight loss and lifelong fitness. So this comes at a good time. I think we're all getting ready for summer to come. We're all feeling a little bit body conscious, and we're trying to get into good shape and be in good health. So this will be a very useful title. Tell us about Become Your Best Body by Justin Harvey.
Chapeau, Justin Harvey. Truly, hats off to you. I approached your book, Become Your Best Body, the way I approached the Atkins, South Beach books, etc. over the years, expecting a miracle. But this time I see it's possible. I came away with several points to ponder, starting with the fact that it's not all my fault. As much as my weight yo-yoed over the past few years, so over the last 180 years did the opinion of scientists and the world's best medical minds yo-yo. Fats and red meat will give you a heart attack, or will they? Exercise makes you lose weight, or does it? More protein, or less? Carbs, no carbs. Carbs make you fat. Oh, yes, they do. No wonder I've been confused and, for the most part, over my ideal weight. Harvey deals with everything, and while much is based on his own experience and his own journey from slim young man to large older one, he has done an amazing amount of research, including, for instance, the evidence of how the hunter-gatherer Hazdas burned as many kilojoules in a day of foraging than the pavement pounders do today. Make no mistake, exercise is important, but extreme exercise may not be beneficial and even harmful, according to Harvey. It includes what you can and what you shouldn't eat if you are serious about changing your lifestyle. And for the first time, I understand how it really works. He gives advice about falling off the wagon and, of course, getting back on it. A very, very comprehensive section on why and what exercise is good for you, from yoga and Pilates to cycling, swimming, and so on, even though exercise won't make you lose weight but will improve your general well-being. He writes about exercising with disabilities. He's even motivated me to go back to the gym for aerobic exercise or swimming, because while I walk a lot, it's not at a fast enough pace for the good of the heart. It's not all doom and gloom, of course. alcohol is possible to be used for cooking, and while we are doing so, he says, we may have the occasional drink, but without sugary mixes. His recipe section includes the famous Banting nutty crackers, but also, new to me, a Banting bread using Heber flour and buttermilk, both now on my shopping list, along with avocado, along with berries, the two fruits permissible. Rule of thumb, if it grows underground, avoid it. Butternut is also a sort of no-no, even though it grows above ground. Yes, Banting isn't new, but the reasons for Banting, by introducing Banting, are new to me. Banting was so fat he couldn't even tie his shoelaces. The Real Meat Revolution by Tim Noakes is my go-to, and was a source of reference here, of course. This one just makes sense on all counts. Harvey should have called this book Beyond Banting, for it is so much more. The reason behind and the reasons for a good lifestyle, it's definitely my now and forever go-to diet Bible.
While we're talking about this kind of book, I want to tell you about a book that I recently picked up. It's called The South African Keto and Intermittent Fasting Cookbook. It's by Rita Fenter and Natalie Lawson. I'm going to tell you that again. It's called The South African Keto and Intermittent Fasting Cookbook by Rita Fenter and Natalie Lawson. It's a bit of a mouthful, which is appropriate because this book is all about mouthfuls. So what I can tell you about this book, well, actually what I can tell you about me, is that for the last 20 years, I've been on a bit of a massive life-changing weight loss journey. Over 20 years ago, I was diagnosed with pre-diabetes leading towards diabetes, and I realized that I had to completely change my life. And I started to do that. I've done it very, very slowly. And over the last 20 years, I can tell you that I've lost the equivalent of a big child or a small adult. So I've been on a real journey with this. And I've experimented with a lot of diets and cookbooks along the way. So people ask me, you know, it's the kind of thing you look like you've suddenly lost a lot of weight, but it really there is no overnight success. This is a marathon. And people often ask me how I lost all this weight. And I can tell you very honestly that I attribute it to a mix of, well, I train very hard, so I exercise every day, but I also attribute it to a mix of keto diet and my own kind of version of intermittent fasting. So then when I saw this new cookbook coming out, it really caught my eye. As I mentioned, it's about keto and intermittent fasting. What's interesting about this book is that it's not just a cookbook. It's actually a lifestyle and a cookbook. So the first bit of the book is made up of the theory behind both the keto lifestyle and the intermittent fasting lifestyle. They've also included some incredibly interesting testimonials from different people who have been on this journey and done these diets and what's worked for them and what hasn't worked for them. They also have very specific meal plans, and they include nutritional information, they include carbo counts, they include a 12-step program if you want one, and they also have a very vast Q&A section, frequently asked questions section, which is very useful. And that's all before you even get to the recipes. After that, they hit into some fantastic recipes. They're beautifully photographed. What I also like is that they've included shopping lists. That's always useful for me because I'm a bit of a scatterbrained shopper, so that's very useful. So I would say if you're thinking about changing your lifestyle, if you'd like to lose a couple of kilos, if you'd like to change your entire lifestyle, if you just want to do a little bit of research and see what everyone's talking about with the keto revolution and the intermittent fasting revolution, this is a really good book to get you started. And it sounds to me like it will go very neatly alongside Become Your Best Body, which we just heard about by Justin Harvey, which Shirley Gula just told us about. So there you have it, two books that will help you become your best body, I guess, and to create a lifestyle that you can continue and hold on to that will help you get into really good health. Again, we have a very appropriate track we're going to turn to now after all that talk about becoming your best body. We're going to play Any Dream Will Do, and this is by Rocco De Villiers. Thank you. That was Any Dream Will Do by Rocco DeVilliers, and you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, and our show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. We're coming to our absolutely final segment of the show now. We're about to wrap things up, but this is the one we've all been waiting for. Vanessa Levenstein is here to interview Sipiwe Gloria Ndlovu about the creation of Half Broken People, which is her new novel. If you are a regular listener to the show, you might get a bit annoyed with us because Vanessa Levenstein and I are always banging on about this author, Sipiwe Gloria Ndlovu. She is without a doubt in my top five South African authors. I think she might be in Vanessa's top three South African authors. When we heard she had a new novel coming up, we were over the moon excited. Her last novel was called The Quality of Mercy, and it was one of the best novels that I read last year. She is really in a league of her own. As I said in the beginning of the show, I'm willing to bet good money that this book will absolutely make it through in the Sunday Times Literary Awards in 2025. So welcome to the show, Vanessa Levenstein, and our very favorite, Sipiwe Gloria Ndlovu. We were all fangirling big time when she came into the studio. Over to you.
The creation of Half Broken People is the fourth City of Kings novel by Sipiwe Gloria Ndlovu. Spanning over a century, the novel threads through the lives of four women. It's narrated by an anonymous woman who has visions of the misremembered, misforgotten, and forgotten women. This is a quote from the book. "For is it not every man's dream someday to meet his childhood hero, to speak to a real life legend, so as to know what exactly could be made possible in a man's life?" We've interviewed Sipiwe before on Book Choice, but only via Zoom. However, here she is in studio with us. So hello and welcome. You are a real life literary legend, our hero.
Oh, wow. Good morning. Thank you, Vanessa, for having me. This is an amazing opportunity to finally see you face to face and have a conversation with you face to face.
To plunge right into the book, Charlotte Bronte put a mad woman in an attic. Jean Race deconstructed Jane Eyre with wide sagacity. You put a mad woman in an attic and added yellow wallpaper. It feels like a conversation with writers who came before you.
Definitely. So for me, I had the, dubious privilege of having to study Jane Eyre in high school for A-levels. And I remember being very struck by the post-colonial reading of The Woman in the Attic as sort of like England and Britain trying to come to terms with their colonial past without necessarily realizing it. And obviously, Jean Rhys's White Sagacity also was a great way of thinking about that. But I also found that it was a conversation that wasn't complete if we didn't bring the African aspect of it as another place where Britain was colonizing. So what does that look like? What does that narrative look like on the continent? What is it about our past as a post-colonial settler colony that we are trying not to come to terms with? And how can we come to terms with it? So what is it about this violent past that we have to contend with?
And you do contend with it. And you also demonstrate how literature can appropriate and colonize. I mean, references to King Solomon's Mines. Does this book attempt to right the wrongs of the past, starting with the Silver Wings, the return of the Silver Wings?
Definitely. I think for me, what I love about being able to write as a black woman from an ex-settler colony is that I know for sure I was not supposed to do this, right? So this is an act of defiance on so many levels. I was never supposed to be able to engage with the past in this way. I was not supposed to be able to write back to it. And so just existing as a writer and being amongst a lot of black writers, this is an amazing thing that is happening and that we're doing. And so I feel very privileged to be able to do it because I am very much aware that when Rider Haggard wrote King Solomon's Mines and he wrote the character of Gagool, now that I'm a middle-aged woman, it's supposed to be me, right, in many ways, that he wasn't thinking that at some point some middle-aged black woman was going to write about this and try and definitely deconstruct it and look at how it had been such a damaging image to write and then also inherit as black women. And yeah, so just being able to write against that is just a powerful thing.
I love the way you say write against this because your characters also went against what was expected of them in all three novels, especially the women, and in this one as well. They don't accept what history has given them, and they do question, and that comes out throughout, and it makes the reader question a lot what's happened. What are your silver wings?
What are my silver wings? So for me, the idea of silver wings are these things that are entrenched in many different narratives. There's the mythological side, there's the magical, but there's also the very real material wings themselves, and that then become part of a narrative of Africa losing its artifacts, right, or having its artifacts stolen and then not returned. And the narratives around why, you know, we can't have them back because we don't know how to look after them, we don't know how to value them. So we deserve the theft that happened. We deserve not to get them back. And it's a narrative, I think, that a lot of people are hearing and talking about, but at the same time, it's so very much a narrative that began so long ago, and the people who are saying these things have been saying them for like 150 years without questioning their own stance on why they think it's okay to actively say we took things without permission, or, you know, we started a war and took things. And those things already belonged to a cultural context that has never been rectified. So if something was used in a ritual and you took it, what happened to that ritual after you took it, you know? And you're not necessarily thinking of that. And the truth is, a lot of these artifacts and things are not necessarily on display in museums. They're like in basements, not even being displayed. They're just something that we have. And so I don't understand how you're valuing it if it's in a basement, and saying that we wouldn't know how to value it. And yet, it doesn't really matter what we did with it. It was ours for us to do with what we want. And so you really don't have any kind of argument you can make for why you still have them that makes sense.
Well, it's the appropriation, and that appropriation extends to the appropriation of women's bodies. It was shocking. And value, you bring up value a lot. And it's for us to choose how we value that which is precious to us and important. And there are also haunting references to Toni Morrison's Beloved. As a reader, I often felt as if I was punched in the stomach. There was nothing to quite prepare me for what was going to happen. Was it hard going to those places for you?
Definitely. I think I find the other novels, the novels by the women, to be not difficult, but also part of a healing process, from, you know, counter-reading Jane Eyre to White Sagacity to Rebecca to all these things to Toni Morrison. I think they are part of my own coming to understand the role of women, the role of these histories of violence that have taken place and what they've done to women's bodies. I think the difficult text to really contend with was Rider Haggard's King Solomon's Mines, because there is no healing. It's just sort of like this very colonial narrative that does not question itself, that is setting very definite ways of defining womanhood and blackness that we have inherited up to today. And in some ways, we haven't come to actually start to question those, because they've just become a very natural part of how we think about, you know, sort of a woman who is very, very knowledgeable in a certain way is still seen as dangerous. And we don't think about, where did that come from? A black woman especially. So we don't think of, where did that image come from? Where did that idea come from? And it comes from these colonial texts.
So we talk about healing. I mean, the book's title is The Creation of Half-Broken People. People have been broken by oppression, poverty, abuse, or mental illnesses. Can they be fixed?
Yes.
What a lovely short answer.
I definitely believe, yes, they can, but we have to be able to have conversations that are difficult in order for that to happen.
I just want to say to the listener, we're talking about a lot of heavy topics, but if you've read any of Sipiwe's previous books, you'll know there's so much humor. There's so much irony. I mean, I laughed loud during the book. Humor, it's also a way to heal, isn't it?
Definitely. I think what I find funny about a lot of the colonial narrative is that it took itself so seriously and never anticipated its own antithesis. And I just find it so interesting that it never did, because obviously people were going to not all be on the same page about this, right? And so to come to a place and feel like you can just rule over it without any sort of resistance is already so much hubris that you have to find it funny, right? Like that people will be like, oh, it's okay for you to come and, you know, rule over us for 200 years. We'll be fine with that.
Yeah.
Of course not. No one's going to be fine with that.
And the Jumbie Good Foundation and Jumbie Good 9. No, he's not good. I mean, your use of language, your use of names. I think one of the greatest lines that I have ever read comes from the first book.
Jeannie says, "You cannot break me. You see, I know for certain that my parents were capable of flight." And that is in reference to the Silver Wings. Mm-hmm. So I suppose there is an excuse to bring it in. But why I want to bring that line in is you've got this incredible way of exploring history, deconstructing, being funny, but also internalizing what happens in a person's heart. And you give your reader strength.
Thank you.
How many more cities of King's books can we look forward to? Please, please, please say lots.
Lots. I'm hoping at least another three.
And I hope that our next conversation we back here in studio. Absolute privilege and an honor to speak to you today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, Vanessa Levenstein. That was such a thoroughly, beautifully researched interview. And you've read the book so deeply. And I know you've really enjoyed this process. So we're very grateful for all your hard work and effort. And Sipiwe, we're so grateful that you could make the time to come into the studio and be so generous with your time to talk about this masterpiece of a novel. And that brings us to the end of the show. You've been listening to Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. And I hope there's been something in the show that's appealed to you, that you've made a list and you're going to go looking for it, because there's been some really great options. And I want to thank all our reviewers and interviewers and all the publishers who send us these beautiful books, and also all the authors who take the time to come and spend time with us and who spend all this backbreaking time writing these incredible books. We're going to play out with Licorice by Nossa Vida, and we'll see you again in 2 weeks' time. Until then, happy reading.
FM.